Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with Louie D'Souza and Yuona Thiessen. Today is Monday, April the 20th, 2020. It's 4 p.m. New York time, wherever you are in the world. Thanks for joining us for another episode of LOA Today, your daily dose of happy. And we're happy to be starting the week once again with these five shows we do every single week, Monday through Friday. And we're really glad to have you join us as well. Hope you're doing well with all the craziness with the pandemic and so forth. Hopefully you're not spending a whole lot of time focused on that. Hopefully you're focusing your attention on other stuff. And I say that, guys, because I told you about this, Yuona, over the weekend, but I had an interesting experience. I learned firsthand just how quickly we can make ourselves sick, which was not my intention, I have to say. but I ended up, I was taking a shower on Saturday morning and I got into this little, you know how you can kind of, your mind can kind of get into these little things and you're play acting things and so forth. I was kind of playing out a scenario and it was not a happy scenario, but I was kind of exploring it to see, you know, how does it all add up in certain ways, and ended up getting to the point where I started to feel depressed. And by the time I was ready to get out of the shower, I was feeling nauseous, ready to practically fall over. I could barely move out of the shower. I mean, I thought I had COVID. I mean, I was in really bad shape. And I realized that in 15 minutes flat, I had gone from perfectly healthy, well and happy to sick as a dog. And I couldn't believe it, how quickly I was able to do that. Well, with a little help from my wife, Louise, reverse that. First of all, I recognized what I had done. Second of all, I resolved never to do that again. And then third of all, I just started reversing the process. And it took a little while because I had gotten myself down to a really, really low vibration place. It took a while to kind of remember how you do it, but I got there and about 15 minutes later, I was fine. But a very interesting experience. I mean, Louie, we talk a lot about how powerful the mind is and how we really are the ones who through our thoughts and our feelings initiate wellness, but we don't really think about how we initiate sickness. And I proved it to myself in spades over the weekend.
Yes. In a matter of 15
minutes. So what were you thinking that precipitated it?
I was just playing out a scenario in my head between two people who had recently met. They're young people and neither one of them had a high level of self-confidence. And I was just trying to kind of imagine for myself, okay, so what are the different ways they could lack self-confidence? Kind of like leading up to topics to talk about later on. And I got into it so deeply that I depressed the heck out of myself.
Wow.
You see how powerful his mind
is. Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable. I had never thought you could make yourself that sick that
so quickly. Yeah.
But you can.
It's amazing. Wow.
But it's interesting how Abrams says that you didn't get whatever those symptoms were. What were the symptoms?
I was nauseous. I had no energy. Just sort of general pain, almost like early stages of flu. You know, aches and pains and that kind of thing.
So they were just saying, you know, that you don't get nauseous because you're thinking of nausea. You don't get those kind of things because you're thinking that. You get it because of a combination of negative thinking.
Yes.
On any subject.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens the gap to get nailed by something.
Yes.
And the other thing that you talked about, which was very interesting, that my sister once said, you said, as soon as I became aware of it, I turned it around. And my sister said to me once, many, many years ago, she said, once you're aware of something, you're halfway to solving it.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it took quite some time to come back, but it was probably about 20 minutes to come back. And so it
in
was
previous lifetimes, it's taken a whole lifetime.
That's true. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's true.
Yeah, no, we don't appreciate sometimes how quickly we are turning things around compared to how we used to. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the awareness is so powerful, you know. I think that's one of the biggest gifts of the law of attraction to me is that the awareness of my power, my ability, my talents, my skills in that area, just the awareness of that is so, so empowering and so, uplifting, you know, just that was like a huge, aha moment for me when I learned about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
about the power of thought or about what precisely?
Huh? Oh, that I have the, I can choose, you know, which way I want to continue going as far as my thoughts and my emotions and stuff are concerned. Because before that, I thought that it was, I was at the mercy of the circumstances or the environment or whatever.
Yes. So you're going from disempowerment to empowerment based on clarity or knowledge of how things actually work.
Yes.
Which I like to term rules to the game of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it is, except it was more than a game for me.
It's all a game, Walt.
Let's just say it was a very real game.
Very expensive game.
Well, actually, it wasn't all that expensive. I mean, emotionally, it took it out of me. In fact, the rest of the day, I deliberately spent the rest of the day focused totally on things that felt good to me, just to kind of continue the convalescence, shall we call it?
Yes, indeed.
Whoa, yeah.
I loved what a student was bitching to the master. He was saying, "Master, it's easy for you to deal with this sickness or to deal with that problem and to deal with this and to deal with that." And he said, "You know, you don't seem to even have any problems." And he said, "No, it's not true." He said, "The only difference between you and me is I handle them when they're small."
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine, okay, we're in that 15-minute process with the small. I guess it was before I started the conversation in my head.
And that's an interesting awareness as well. Where does it start and how does it start? Yeah,
it really
is. I think that's what happens. You get, as you become more experienced, you're able to catch that earlier
Absolutely.
And earlier.
Yes. That's what Abram's talking about with step five, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you're catching yourself quicker and quicker or turning it on a dime, when you know what you don't want, you know what you do want.
Well, I turned it on a dime. Now what I need to do is be able to, on demand, go in the positive direction as fast as I went in the negative direction. Right. I mean, I can go pretty quickly in the positive direction, certainly a lot faster than I could say 5 years ago.
Right.
But I'm not sure I can get there in 15 minutes yet. Maybe half an hour, but not
well, that's good. That's good.
But the more you practice it, the quicker it becomes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's all about continuing to practice.
Practice.
and being even more committed to the practice.
Right.
That's one thing that came out of this. I mean, we talk often about how the contrast is where we discover what it is that we don't want, shoots off that rocket of desire of what we do want. It creates a clarity of knowing what it is that we don't want. Well, I have a really big clarity, bigger than I had on Friday, as to what it is I don't want. I definitely don't want that. And now I also have a newfound respect for just how powerful my mind is.
To a
degree that I did not really totally grasp. Intellectually I did, but you know, there's a certain level where I guess there's always a little bit of doubt going on, and that doubt got erased really quickly.
Yeah.
but you know that. That practice, going back to what Yona said last time, it was really interesting to me to hear how much the scientific community have now come into the understanding that it is the other states or the meditative state or the, what's it, alpha state?
Yeah, the alpha brainwave state.
The alpha brainwave state that people are, is far more powerful than the practice aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me something that you remember Deepak Chopra's mentor. I don't know if you know who he was, but he was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Yeah, I know of him. Okay.
So he headed up the TM, but he's passed away now.
Right. Yeah.
But Deepak said to Maharishi, he said to him, "You know, focusing on what you want or thoughts are very, very powerful."
Mm-hmm.
And Maharishi smiled at him and said, these are Deepak's words. He said that silence or the lack of thought is more powerful.
Mm.
This was said many, many years ago, which was very interesting to me. And how this knowledge, this Vedic knowledge has been around for a long, long time, And the way transcendental meditation always talks about it is the gap between thoughts.
Right.
Space between thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think that means? Because the reason I asked that is I was doing a retrospective. I was looking back at some of the old Star Wars movies, and the later episodes talked about that with the Force being kind of their equivalent of
source
energy, right? And they talked about the Force being between objects, between people, between, you know, everything. It was the in-between stuff. What do you think he means by that, by the in-between, by the silence?
The space.
Why is that so powerful?
Well, the way Abram would explain it was that the only thing holding you back from that powerful source is focus or thoughts about what you don't want, or collection of past thoughts that are vibrating within you about what you don't want. So if you remove all that, you need to get to the silence, to get to that space or that no space, so that the cork, which has been pushed under by the resistance of what you don't want, can now just automatically rise to the surface, and you can have the power that creates worlds in it.
So kind of the equivalent of what we talk about when we talk about, say, the riding the raft on the river analogy that Abraham comes up with, or anything that has to do with water passing through cracks in the rock, and that's basically getting past the resistance. So all you need is just to open up that crack a little bit, the water gets through, and just that little bit is enough to remove the resistance so stuff can get through.
Absolutely. As Abram says, even a second or two is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I read about that in Deepak Chopra's book. And what I took away from it was that the gap or the silence was about that momentary time, although it's not in terms of time, where there's no thought. Your conscious mind essentially is no longer actively generating thoughts. So there's that quiet, that stillness. So you're not, the conscious mind is involved in assessing everything in your environment, what you're seeing and hearing, and all the things coming through your senses, your five senses, is processing that constantly. And in between the time when you're not doing that, you're not processing anything, you're not judging anything, there's that stillness that allows the non-conscious part of your mind, that non-judgmental awareness, to sort of bubble up through the surface, you know? And it's so outside of our experience. It's hard to describe, because, you know, it's very rare when you get to experience that. And even the people who have experienced it or have difficulty explaining it, but it has to do with that shutting down of the conscious mind, so that the other parts of you, the non-conscious, or I shouldn't say non-conscious, sounds like you're unconscious, but the part that's not the logical mind actually is now more doing the observing, basically.
It's an interesting concept.
There was a silence.
Well, yeah, I mean, how do you grasp that which is not? How do we grasp this?
It deserves silence.
Yes, yes.
We will now observe a moment of silence for silence.
Exactly.
May the Force be with you.
Yeah. Well, it's brain gymnastics trying to get around that, trying to make sense out of it.
Yeah, it's so new and foreign to what we've been thinking of most of our lives. So.
I mean, I was just thinking, as you were talking there, I was thinking, are there instances that I can point to in my own experience where I did have that experience? Mm-hmm. And I think I may have, actually, now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. For instance, there have been, we kind of experienced it to a degree anytime that we're driving and we're driving on autopilot and we're not really aware of how we're getting to wherever it is we're going to. And then we get there and we try to remember how we got there and we really can't remember the trip, that kind of thing. So that's kind of an example of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also experienced it. I'm pretty sure in these instances, and I can't think what they call it, there's a name for this, where you kind of do like this quantum leap thing where you're in one place and then in the very next instant, driving is a great way to explain this. You're in this one place, you're on the road, and the very next instant, you're five blocks down. Mm-hmm. Not that there was a gap of time that you didn't remember, but there was no gap.
Hmm. Yeah.
And for whatever reason,
your awareness was,
your awareness was disappeared for a moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember in his book, I was reading it the other day, Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, Deepak Chopra. And he talks about one of the ways you can try to, access this silence. He says is by actually observing a period of silence, like going on a period of days where you don't talk. You don't talk to anyone. You don't interact. I mean, I guess he's done it. And
He does it in his practice. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I've only seen this.
People to wander around silence. No. Big sign around their chest.
Yeah, they can't talk. And what he says is that when the conscious mind, and I think he may or may not have used the word ego, when the ego realizes there's nothing to say, nothing to contribute, nothing to share, there's nobody to talk to, then it just quits. It says, okay, well, since you're not going to talk to anyone, there's no point in me judging everything. So
the way I've noticed it in myself is the mind seems to go into neutral. It's still kind of spinning, but it's not grabbing onto anything. It's just, going round and round and round.
Yeah.
And it's very relaxing. It's incredibly relaxing. Yeah.
You know, that reminded me just this week, I started for the first time Vipassana meditation. I've done TM and I've done other types of meditation, but I saw it. I was exposed to it before, but I never really paid much attention. But this week, for some reason, I was reading a book about it and I decided to try practicing it. And it was kind of like that. And I was sharing with Wolf a little bit on Saturday, where you are learning to be just the silent observer of everything, of your thoughts, of your what's going on in your body, just being that observer where it's hard to explain, but it's amazingly relaxing. Oh my God, it felt so good. I was telling Walt, for the first time, I'm actually looking forward to meditating because before I struggled with meditating because I, you know,
there is a corner with meditation that you turn and it's amazing once
yes.
you get there.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm turning the corner now.
It's like, I'm always referring to Abram, but Abram says it can become quite addictive.
yes, yeah.
I can get that.
Yeah, well, he in the book I was reading talked about that. He says that there might come a time when you're meditating and you experience the bliss, and they say don't try to hold on to that because you will. Just observe it like you would observe even the not
It'll
so.
It'll come and it'll go.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it is quite interesting.
You know, all this talk about not talking, you know, going through silence for periods of time, it reminds me of a very, very old joke, which I think I've told previously on the podcast, but I'll tell it again anyway because it's fun. It's the story of a reporter who ends up going to visit a monastery so he can report on the monastery.
Yeah.
And he's met at the door by one of the monks, and the monk greets him warmly and welcomes him, invites him to come in. And he says, one thing I need to tell you, we're in a period right now where all the brothers are involved in a vow of silence. So we are all silent all day long. Nobody talks. Nobody will respond to you if you say anything. Mm-hmm. However, there is one break. When we have our meals, we'll break it up a little bit. We won't actually break the vow of silence, but we like to socialize a little bit. So what we do is we like to tell jokes to each other. And because we know the jokes so well, we've numbered them. And so we just say the number and that's all. And that limits the amount of talking that we do. So he goes through the day and he's watching these monks and he's learning what they're doing and so forth. And then it comes to the meal time and he sits down with his friend, his host, and the others at the tables, and they're eating silently. And then all of a sudden one calls out, 26, and there's this laughter that permeates the room. There's silence for a while. And another monk says, 14. And that leads to a little bit more laughter. You know how laughter kind of becomes a little bit contagious and so forth. And the reporter is looking at his host and he's like, really? This is what these guys do? And the monk says, well, go ahead, try it yourself. He says, all right. 127. There's dead silence.
Of course.
And then the place erupts in laughter. And the monks are falling all over the tables. They're falling onto the floor. His host has lost it completely. Food is flying from all the laughter. Finally, his host recovers himself long enough. The reporter says, what did I say? What did I say? And the monk says, they never heard that joke before.
Oh,
brilliant
one. I was just thinking how difficult that would be for me to a pledge of silence. Let me tell you, as you guys can probably guess, I love to talk. You know, my husband, now that he's working from home, he has to listen to me talk almost. You know, he's in the office sometimes and I am like in another room reading, and I would try as hard as I can not to go and disturb him. But sometimes I read something or something happens and I just am like, can I share this with you? And then he'll say, okay. And then I'll say, okay, I won't come back until 12 o'clock. And of course, in the next hour, I'm back with something else to share. And I think he could probably go, perfectly days without saying a word.
Oh, he's in our family, he's well known for that, actually.
Yes.
That's one of his greatest strengths.
Oh, I tell you, yes.
There have been times where, especially when we were all quite young, where we weren't even sure where he was.
Yeah, I have those moments where I don't know where he is because he's dead silent.
Isn't this an interesting dynamic? You've got the talker and you've got the listener.
Yes. Absolutely. I think that's what attracted us to each other. So, yeah, because he loves the fact that I talk.
If you were my partner, I would be very good with a Teflon coat. It would go in one side and come out the other. I can't handle too much talking.
it's a skill.
but what I'm always amazed at is how perfectly people seem to choose their partners.
Yeah.
I often think it would be things that are similar, you like doing things together, but it's not like that.
No,
it's usually completely the opposite.
That's true, because, if I was married to someone who talked as much as I did, I probably
endless fight for supremacy.
Exactly.
Not necessarily. I mean, I've known people, including couples, who were talkers, both sides talk, and they just both talked. Nobody ever listened.
Yeah, there's many different dynamics.
You can't
pinpoint it into. This just happens to be rather a clear one.
It certainly worked in our relationship with Louise and me, because you may find this hard to believe, but she's actually the talker. I'm not the talker.
Yeah, I know she's the talker.
I know that's hard to believe, but it's true. It was actually a skill I had to develop in order to do the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I was glad to develop it. But it took a while. It took a while just thinking of what to say because I wasn't used to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while that became easier because despite the fact that this is a relatively simple topic, it has endless, endless roots to take with it. Anyway, speaking of topics, you had texted me something over the weekend, and we didn't really discuss it at all, but I like the idea of it.
Sorry, we're finished.
See why I didn't marry someone like Louis?
I've been thinking of all these stories, but I'm not going to try to tell them all. We'll never get anything done. But what was the topic you had in mind? Tell Louis about it so he knows.
Sure. Heart intelligence. I've been reading all about heart intelligence and learning some absolutely fascinating things. And it's helping me to understand some of the admissions that are given in the teachings of the law of attraction. Why there's this emphasis on one, combining your thoughts with an elevated emotion, and also why gratitude is so powerful, and understanding why even I remember, Walt, you and I, we had this epiphany when we were talking about the secret, and then you know, after a few years of having seen it the first time, we came upon the idea that it was more than just the thoughts, that there was an emotional component to the manifestation,
right?
That was not
that
as heavily emphasized. Yeah. So
I remember where we had that conversation, which is pretty cool.
I know.
That was a while ago.
Yeah. But so, you know, learning about the heart has been absolutely fascinating. One of the things that first got all this started was that in 1991, this doctor by the name of Dr. Amwar, he's a medical doctor / scientist, and he discovered that in every heart, there is this section where there's a collection of neurons. It's the only other place in the body that there's a collection of neurons outside of the head.
Okay.
And so there's like this 40 to 50,000 neurons in this place on your heart that actually they have since learned is able to think and feel and remember and function just like a brain. So much so that they now refer to this part of the heart as the heart brain. And so now there's a whole new field of neurocardiology that has been opened up since that discovery. But what they're learning is that this heart brain is actually, it communicates with the head. So the heart and the brain, the cranial brain and the heart brain communicates. But the heart brain does most of the talking. So there's information going from the brain to the heart, and there's information going from heart to the brain. But there's a lot more information going from the heart to the brain than there is going from the brain to the heart. So the brain is actually the boss of this whole dynamic. And it's in line with something what Louis was saying.
Did you mean to say the heart is the brain rather than the mind?
Right. The heart. Yeah, the heart is the brain. And it goes back to what you were talking about, how you mentioned some of these discoveries in science align with some of these teachings from, you know, primitive practices, ancient medicine, you know, traditional medicine, where they focused a lot on the heart, right? And even in our colloquial speaking, some of those traditions still persist. You know, we talk about where we feel things, where sometimes say, I have this intuition, you know, you usually point to your heart. Or when you talk about, when you talk about who you are, you always point to your heart. Or even if you ask little kids, so where's Johnny? They usually point right to the center of their chest, you know, because there's this kind of basic understanding that the core of your being is actually in the heart and not in the head. But the other things that I've been learning about this whole heart brain idea is that not only is there more information going from the heart to the brain than the other way around, is that the heart is able to synchronize all the systems in the body in a particular state that is called coherence, heart coherence. And when that happens, so it actually controls all, it is able to cause all the body system to vibrate at a related frequency so that they're all kind of in harmony. And when that happens, it enhances the performance of all of your body system. So it initiates a kind of a healing, and it also improves your cognition, but it also feels a lot feels energetic and healthy and happy. And you can do this same, you can basically do this deliberately when you express feelings like joy and appreciation and gratitude. And they've been able to measure that and show the coherence patterns of the heart and the brain and other organs. And finally, I want to talk about the fact that they've been able to measure the vibration, the energy coming from the different organs. And as I was I hinted on last week that the energy coming from the heart is 1,000 times, the magnetic field specifically is 5,000 times to be exact, stronger than that coming from the brain. And the electrical field is 60 times stronger than that coming from the brain. So the heart is a much more powerful source of vibration. And in Dr. Dispenza's book, he says that we don't attract what we think or what we want. We attract what we're being, and our state of being is a combination of our thoughts and our feelings.
That's an interesting concept. It's a concept that has been carried by a number of different researchers. I know there's actually a heart mind.
Yeah, the Heart Math Institute.
Heart Math Institute. That's what it is. Yeah,
they do a lot of that work.
That does that work. Interesting term too. Heart intelligence. They could have chosen a number of different ways of expressing connection to the brain, but they chose intelligence. I wonder why that particular word.
Well, because they
EQ instead of IQ, they should have used.
Yeah,
right. So they talk about they do talk about EQ, but I think they specifically chose intelligence
the reference to the brain. Yeah,
right.
Comparison. Yeah.
Yes, but also that it can be a guiding force in terms of helping you make decisions and evaluate things and, you know, come to understanding. So there's some kind of intelligence that's specific to the heart, and it's independent of the brain.
To me, the most fascinating thing about the emotions is what Abram has taught, and I haven't heard any scientist or anybody anywhere on the planet mention it in any shape or form, is that this is the way I like looking at it, is you've got this guidance, which we could say is our guardian angel. It's a term we've used for centuries. So we're now getting a revised version of the guardian angel, the upgraded version, understanding. So we've got this guardian angel.
2.0 for you computer freaks.
Yeah. So you've got this enhanced guardian angel sitting there and saying, okay, every time you know what you don't want, you're making a pool of what you do want. You're getting a better idea of it. I'm going to store all that, keep it here. And whenever you're heading towards everything that you want, that you've put in your little pool, I'm going to run out there as your emotional guidance. And I'm going to say, yeah, some negative emotion if you're going away from it. Yeah, some positive emotion if you're heading towards it. And to me, that was profound. That is the most profound thing I've ever come across anywhere ever, is that your emotions are your guidance telling you if you feel bad, you're going away from everything you want. If you feel good, you're going towards everything you want.
Profound because of the simplicity of it?
The simplicity and what I feel is the accuracy of it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The correctness the way it is-ness of it.
I think other people have expressed it, maybe not in those same words, but for example, other teachers say that, I know, for example, that Dr. Dispenza talks about, and Dr. Chopra talks about that too, that your emotions are the connection that connects you to your subconscious. And so when you are trying to assess an experience, a situation, a memory, whatever, it is your emotions that lets you know if this thing is conducive to happiness and joy and contentment, or if it is not. And it's similar to what the heart intelligence people are saying, is that when there is coherence in the system, when all the body systems are vibrating at the same frequency and they're in harmony, it feels good. When it doesn't, there is an irregularity or an incoherence, and that doesn't feel good. So one is associated with a good feeling, coherence, and when you're out of, the body systems are out of alignment, you feel a discomfort that's translated into the negative bad feelings. Mm.
I just don't feel a huge amount of clarity with that. It doesn't point to me, to my specifics, to where I'm going. It just is rather scientific as usual. She hasn't broken it down into something that's real tangible. I can get my hands on and put my teeth into and just run with and, you know, work. So, you know, the way Abrams explained it to me is profound.
Yeah.
Really is the simplicity, the directness, the reason that you might feel positive emotion with something and I would feel negative emotion on exactly the same thing is explained in the idea that, you know, you've put in your bank everything you want, and what's in your bank and what's in my bank is two different banks completely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So therefore I might feel watching the same situation, I might feel positive emotion and you might feel negative emotion.
Right.
That also points to the uniqueness of all the different individuals out there and how they can see the same experience but have different emotions based on it.
Would call the bank is what I would call the subconscious. That's how I would define it. So
subconscious has got from the scientific or so many people have got different ideas what that is, but is often looked at more of what you don't want that's in the bank rather than what you do want that's in the bank.
That's often true.
Yeah, and that's true, but it's not accurate, though. I mean, I know that's the general consensus. When people think subconscious, they often think about all the bad experiences, the trauma, and all the stuff you don't want. But for me, when I think of subconscious, I think of unique things that are specific to me and to my life, and only I can be in tune with. And sometimes even I may not be exactly, you know, clear on what's in my subconscious in terms of, you know, I have certain preferences that I may not even, I may not be aware of. You know, there's certain things that I like and certain things that I don't like, and I may not be explicitly clear as to why I like it. But if I thought about it, I think, oh, maybe when I was in Trinidad, I had that. So this is bringing back some memory of something. I don't know, you know. So I have all these unique tendencies within me. And so when I when what I want, say, is in alignment with that, I may not know what that is, but it feels good. And so, yeah.
And to bring a third perspective into it, I mean, I agree with both you. I totally agree with Louis. I love the simplicity and the clarity of the Abraham approach. But as you were talking on it, the thought that came to my mind was music.
Mm.
Specifically, I went to classical music. It's the contrast between Beethoven and Mahler. Beethoven is all about the true symphonic sound, the true harmony. Mahler is about all these distortions and sounds that don't really nicely go together and create all this aharmonic stuff that's very, very uncomfortable.
Is it like jazz or no?
What's that?
Is it a jazz-like thing? I don't know. I've never heard the name.
No, it's classical. It's classical music.
Oh, it is classical.
Like a more modern, well, not modern, modern for my generation.
Right.
Would be Joni Mitchell and Lou Reed.
Okay.
You know. You got Joni Mitchell with a nice, quiet, melodic stuff, and Lou Reed.
Yeah.
Not exactly in the same ballpark there.
Right.
I don't know the modern artist well enough to draw a parallel there, but I'm sure there is one somewhere.
Right. But you were saying?
Sorry.
Well, I was just saying that to me, that it spells out what you were talking about specifically with what they call the coherence. Because coherence is basically just a nice, clean sine wave.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not distorted. It's not bouncing all over the place and craziness. Right. It's just staying with a nice, steady sine wave. And that's what you get with harmonics.
Yes. Okay.
Literally, sound harmonics move together.
Right.
If you can watch the graph of pure tones that are an octave apart or a fifth apart, you can see they move perfectly with each other.
Right.
Whereas when you have tones that are enharmonic or disharmonic, they're like, it's like watching one of the the Emoto water experiments, you know, like stuff flying all over the place.
Yes.
So there are a lot of different ways to experience that difference between in alignment, out of alignment, in harmonics, out of harmonic, feel good, not feel good.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I agree that the Abraham approach the emotional guidance scale is the simplest one that I've ever heard of to use, mm-hmm. and very, very accessible. But there are a lot of different examples.
In fact, when I was talking with Mark about this, he started talking about frequency and hertz, and I was like, because he's an engineer, that's how he was able to conceptualize it. But for me, sure. I like Louis was saying, I just know it feels good. That's all I care about. Everybody has a different experience.
And he also made a great point that what feels good to one person doesn't necessarily feel good to another person.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Now that's where positive and negative can actually be hindrances as terms, mm-hmm. because there's sort of a general consensus among many people that what's positive for one should be positive for everybody else, but right. it actually rarely is. That's what's so amazing about it. People have such different tastes, such different preferences.
Yeah. And that's why I personally think it's important to become acquainted with yourself, you know, I think that's important, because otherwise you may try to align yourself with something that is not, is unique to you. And that's what I liked about that assessment that I took last week, and I learned what my, the traits that are high on my particular, whatever you want to call it. I forgot the terms that were used, but the things that are that I value and that I also, demonstrate to a superior extent compared to others relative to other things. So I know what's important to me. I love learning. And so when I'm engaged in that, I am in my happy place.
Yes, we talked about that over the weekend. You are the learner in the family. You love to learn.
Yes. And just knowing that that's one of my high qualities, that kind of gave me a sense of relief. If you can understand that, because people always commented on that, right? And I felt kind of judged a little bit. Like, they're always like, yeah, you're always learning. She's always learning something, And I thought, maybe something was wrong with me.
your guidance was giving you very direct information. If you feel relief or release, you are heading towards what you want.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yes.
And that is very clear. There's no misinterpretation for you on that subject. You're completely accurate. That is good for you. That is what you enjoy. That is what you like. That's what turns you on. Mm-hmm. And you've got the confirmation from your inner guidance.
Which is really important.
In the form of relief rather than feeling good about it, which is the same thing, which works out to be the same thing.
It is, yeah, but it's also valuable to have that information. There was a long portion of my life where I did not understand that relief was actually moving me in the right direction. Mm. You almost have to have that explained to you sometimes. Maybe not everybody, but people like me have to have that explained to us.
No, I think you're right, because I think there is an unspoken concept where society tells you that relief is a cop out. I don't know if that's the word, but there was a kind of idea that when you're small, when you're little, like young, if something brings you relief, then maybe that's too easy for you or something. I don't know, and that makes it.
Oh sure, yeah, that becomes a source.
No pain, no gain is very deeply ingrained in society.
Yes.
Yeah. So right. So it's
very, very deeply in ways and means we haven't even begun to comprehend in ourselves.
So getting back to the concept of heart intelligence, okay, we've outlined what it is. We've outlined the fact that, or you outlined for us, Ioana, the fact that they've drawn these connections. They've noticed how much more powerful the heart is and so forth. What else can we draw from it, though? What other information can we draw from this concept of heart intelligence? Because, if they took the time to name it, there must be something else there.
Yeah, so like the Heart Math Institute, they're, taking this all the way, and they've developed special tools and all kinds of stuff to help you basically get in touch with your heart intelligence and learn from it and use it in your personal life, in your business life. You know, so they actually give lectures to companies for their employees to how to use their heart intelligence. And they focus a lot on how to get into that state of coherence. Because they've shown, which is what most people are concerned about, is that when you are in coherence, your cognition improves. And that's what everybody cares about, you know, as far as the academic world and the business world. They want their brains to be better. They don't care so much about the heart intelligence.
Well, certainly you want it, because she's such a learner. So that's going to be big for her. Yeah.
Of course, yes. And so just knowing that, because, you know, we all have an intuition, we possess an intuition. But a lot of times what happens is we have lost connection with it, if that's the right term. We can't hear from it anymore because, you know, our society places a lot of emphasis on logical thinking and, you know, analysis of the data, you know, the pros and the cons and making decisions based on that. And they downplay the heart intelligence or the intuition. So now they're going full circle and learning how to come to get in touch with that. And so they have this particular technique where they teach you, and it's very simple. Louis will like this.
You're right. If it's simple, I will.
Yes. So what it is simply slowing down your breathing, because they've shown that breathing actually can control the heart rate, and the heart rate is how information is sent from the heart to the brain. The frequency or the rhythm of the beats is it stores information. So when there's heart variability, there's all this kind of distorted information, but when there's coherence. So when you slow your breathing down, you tend to make the rhythm of your heartbeat, it smoothens out. You know, can you imagine a jagged line going across the thing to the nice sine waves as Walter was talking about? So you slow your heart rate down through your breathing, and then you think about happy thoughts, something you like, something you love, some appreciation. You know, you go to a happy place and you focus on your heart and you try to feel those feelings coming from your heart. Your wife is texting me right now, Walt.
Louise does lose track of what time I do the show sometimes.
But yeah, so you slow down your breathing and then you focus on happy emotions and you imagine it coming from your heart. And then you try to, kind of connect your heart. So you imagine the energy from your brain going down to your heart and then radiating out around you. Into your circumstances, to the people around you or to a particular situation that you're dealing with. And that, they've shown actually helps you to get into coherence, gives you guidance, helps, you know, things, you know, just, affect matter around you, whatever that matter is that you are dealing with. So,
I'm always amused at how scientists go get so complicated about something so incredibly simple.
Yeah, because, you know, for
focusing
them,
on nice things is good for you. Wow, I knew that.
Yeah,
but the other thing I wanted to comment on just quickly, because you brought it up, was intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And Carolyn Mace is a medical intuitive and a fascinating study on her own life and her own abilities. It's well worth the little venture. But she was saying, you know, people often say, oh, I'm not intuitive at all. And she said, everybody is so intuitive, they have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought me to Abraham Hicks's understandings is when you feel you like something, you're heading towards what you want. When you feel you don't like something, you're heading way towards what you want. That's what intuition is.
Yeah, I think when I think of intuition, I think in terms of like you mentioned Carolyn Miss, and she's a medical intuitive. She and I'm not sure what that means, but I'm interpreting that to mean that she can look at someone or help people identify, say, a physical ailment, the source of it. That's what I think of.
Shall I break it down briefly to you, because it's fascinating?
Sure.
A doctor met her and she said she's medical intuitive. He said, how good are you? Because he doesn't take any BS.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I'm not really sure. So he they went away and she was in her town, he was in his, and he phoned her up and he said, Caroline, I've got Debbie here. She's 23. And she said, Caroline said, that's enough. She said, she's had a miscarriage. She's got this, she's that, and that. And she went on and on and on and put the phone down. The guy didn't give her any confirmation that this was good, bad, or indifferent. And the doctor eventually phoned her back, you know, a week later and said, oh, I've got this person here. And she gave her the thing. And every single thing she ever said was 100% accurate.
Right. So that to me is more than just focusing on what you do want as opposed to what you don't want. That I think, as far as I understand, there's more involved there than just focusing on what you do want and what you don't want. So I think.
Well, she wants to be able to help others by seeing their things. So I would not dismiss it as not something she wants.
Right. No, no, no. What I'm trying to say is that I can't say that I'm a medical intuitive just by focusing on what I don't want or what I do want. So to say that that's what intuition is all about, I think there might be more involved. As, you know, there's knowing what you don't want and what you do want, which is very simple. But I think getting in touch with your intuitive side
you're talking about tuning in the radio to those frequencies.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No problem with that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, like you said, everybody has that intuition, but some people, for whatever reasons,
don't tune into those stations.
Yeah. Exactly. So,
it's a funny thing too with the various, I'll group them generically as psychic powers. I think people on some level like the idea of a psychic power being something that they don't have because it makes it more mysterious and it makes it more interesting. How the heck did they do this thing? And it also makes it more of a thing to be debunked. Oh, that's just a bunch of nonsense. Because if you're not in any way allowing yourself to be tied to it, in any way connected so that you can actually do it yourself, it makes it bigger. It makes it more fun. It makes it more interesting to talk about. It makes it more interesting to debunk. It makes it, the whole thing. It just becomes this thing. Whereas if we take what Carolyn Mace says, literally, that we are all incredibly intuitive. Mm-hmm. Other psychics have said similar statements about psychic behavior. We are all psychic. Mm-hmm. And many of us have not developed it to the degree that others have, but we all have the same ability. Yeah. It kind of takes the magic away for many people. Yeah. And I think that feeling of magic is a big deal in the sense that it actually becomes a source of resistance.
Yes. And that is actually going back to what Louis was saying, why scientists take something so difficult and make so simple and make it difficult. I think that's one of the things that drives scientists is they believe that if they can collect empirical data on things that we call magic, they can demystify it. For example, the Heart Math Institute, now with all their research, they are teaching people how to get into coherence. And because, you know, the people are living in this very modern technological society, they have the tools to show them when they do get into coherence as opposed to when they not. And it's not just something that they could say, you did or you didn't. Because, you know, we have to admit, when it comes to psychics, there have been psychics and they're psychics. Like, so they're real psychics and not so real, you know, psychics. So people have kind of gotten distrustful of the whole process and they think they're charlatans and, you know, whatever. So when a scientist comes and shows hard data, it makes it easier for some people to accept that these things are happening. And also like the Heart Math Institute, they are now teaching people how to get in coherence, which is actually to get in touch with their intuition. So now they can have a decision, something that they're struggling with. They want to know even a medical problem, and they can tune into their heart and actually learn to listen to what their heart is telling them about where the problem is and what might be a possible solution. So that's why I love the science. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, we had no clue either.
No problem with the science. I've got no problem with the science, and I have no problem with people who love it.
Yeah,
but I'm just amused at sometimes the lengths and breadths they go to prove common sense. It's just amusing to me. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Monroe Institute.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So fascinating guy, because, you know, big businessman suddenly having out of body experiences and totally thrown by it. And many, many years ago, goes to the doctor. Doctor just wants to pump him with medication and tell him there's nothing's happening, and go to a psychologist. It doesn't help anything. And then he started easing into it, and he started relaxing, and he started just letting go and just seeing what happened and getting over the fear, and started having more and more experiences. And then he got a psychologist on board, and they started a little institute. And, you know, he had a farm out in the bushes where nobody could complain or do anything about. And then, you know, it's now a huge institute, if I'm not mistaken. I think the guy's probably passed away by now, but it's a fascinating story. Yeah. And they started with this binaural sound thing.
Binaural beats,
And how it helped. And it explains it in great depth. He really breaks it down so you can really understand what it's doing to bring you to those alpha states, et cetera, so you can leave your body easier, et cetera. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, there have been so many people in history who have tried to, you know, deceive people with some of these. And, you know, we think of religion as an example of that, in terms of, you know, getting them, you know, waving magic wands and doing all kinds of woo-woo stuff. And so there were those who believed, and then there are those who don't. And then sometimes the whole area of that practice gets cast aside because of the charlatans, you know. And there's a whole body of knowledge that's lost. Because if you think now, we had the shamans and the priests and the Buddhists and the yogis and who else? The nuns. All these people have been doing these things for, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, but there are still those who say, oh, that's nonsense, that doesn't work, that's just because they believe it. But now we have science that is able to show. You know, this brings me to one more. I wanted to mention that there was a study done by Harvard University where they wanted to study the brains of Buddhist monks who had been meditating for 10 years or more, to see the differences, the changes in their brains. And there's a funny story where they had a translator between the research, the scientists and the Buddhists. And so the translator was explaining to the monks, so the guy wants to put these electrodes in your head, and they want to study what happens in your head when you guys are meditating. And they practice compassion meditation. And the monk is like, why do they want to put this on my head? They said, oh, they want to see what's happening. And they started laughing, and they said, actually, they're putting it on the wrong organ. So even that, they knew back then that it was the heart was where most of this energetic vibration was coming from. But the scientists still put it on their heads anyway.
Makes the scientists feel better.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing that, again, amuses me with scientists is their strong desire to make other people believe what they've come to understand.
Not all of them do that, though.
No. You mm-hmm. do get the wise ones.
Well, some of them are disbelieving, you know, because in theories, you're supposed to have a hypothesis that you postulate, and then you test and you collect data for or against, and then you analyze the data and you come to a conclusion. The scientific process in a synopsis.
Yeah, but how many times have people gone through all that, come to a conclusion, and then it's wrong 10 years down the line?
Well, so now we have checks and balances in place. So, for example, we have journals, like, you know, science journals and other journals, where when you have completed a report, a science project, you report it. There are going to be editors. There are people who are going to analyze everything you've done. There are those who are going to repeat the experiments to determine if the results are indeed accurate and if it's repeatable. So now it's a little bit more control as far as the field of science is concerned. So a lot of
people understand the law of attraction. If you understand the law of attraction, you start realizing that the person who heads up the experiment is going to have an idea of what he wants or she wants, and they're right. going to attract that.
Absolutely.
And those results are going to come out. So to get a kind of an average, it's, you know, it's an average for the average person, but we're all so unaverage. We're all so uniquely different than.
And there are.
How much validity is there in any of it? So, to me,
there's a lot of validity. That's because there are people like you, scientists.
For you.
No, there's a lot of validity.
No, for you and others, but not for me.
No, listen, it's not just for me and it's not just for others. Because when I do research, I have to account for that, the lack of validity in my results. And I have to demonstrate clearly and accurately, precisely how I dealt with that. For example, you know, as Walt, we had talked about the whole placebo effect. When you are investigating the effect of a drug, you do what is called a double blind placebo controlled experiment. And by double blind, they mean that the doctor, the scientist does not know who is getting the real drug and who's getting the placebo, as well as the subjects. That's the double blinding. Don't know who's getting the placebo and who's getting the results. So you have the scientists, you have the subjects, and you have a third party administrating or, you know, controlling the process. So those are the steps that have been placed among others to account for the, you know, the biases, as you mentioned, you know, because the doctor wants he has a particular result that he's hoping for. So you account for that. You have to always account for these biases. You can't account for all of them, but what you are aware of, you have to make sure that you account for it. Because even in your reporting of the results, you have to discuss how you dealt with this, how you, you know, you reduced or at least eliminated the potential biases in your experiment. So, you know, science has come a long way. Yes, there were times back in the day when people would just run a research and report on what they're finding, but that's not the case anymore. You can't do that. That's not allowed.
Well, I don't know. I think it happens quite a bit, but let me see if I can draw the two together because I think there's a way to connect it. I'm going to bring in a third group too. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to broadly put us LOA people and the psychics and so forth into the intuitive category. And then the rest I'll put into the scientific category. And then there's the third category. The mm-hmm. third category is the airline pilot. Mm-hmm. And the airline pilot, when he's flying his plane, is flying along and he's constantly making adjustments because he's like 90% of the time he's going in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. And so he has to make an adjustment and then he makes another adjustment. And that's how they get from point A to point B. They're constantly making adjustments. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing is true with both the intuitive camp and the scientific camp. Yeah. Now the scientific camp has gotten to the point, like you were saying, Ioana, where they believe that they have eliminated a lot of that stuff. I personally disagree with them on that. I think they've actually increased the amount of it, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I point to something that my friend Cindy Chavez, who does the Wednesday podcast with me, has pointed out in the past, and that is her interpretation and actually the original etymological, original meaning of the word sin, which is missing the mark. Mm-hmm. You know, constantly missing the mark as we're exploring stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, you described very nicely how the scientific process works, and it's a data collection routine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Collect the data and try to learn from it, and constantly making adjustments and shifts and tweaks as you're going along the way. I think the same thing happens in the intuitive category as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you pointed out what you broadly described as charlatans, and certainly it's been described that way. I would suggest the idea that there's no such thing as a charlatan per se, mm-hmm. because even the charlatan is tapping into what they think their victim wants to hear. Mm-hmm. So they really are, they may not be doing it in a way that others would consider to be ethical, but mm-hmm. they're still tapping in. They're still doing, so they're still using it, just not the way necessarily people would like them to use it.
And that causes some of this disbelief that some other people might have. So.
Yeah, sure. And when a psychic, gets something wrong, I mean, mm-hmm. there are some very famous psychics who have just gotten certain things just totally wrong. And of course, that's when all the doubting Thomases come out and say, oh, well, this disproves all their stuff because they got something wrong. Well, if they use the same standard with scientists, we wouldn't have science either.
True. Exactly.
I mean, this is humanity. Humanity
yes, exactly.
is constantly making adjustments. We make a mistake and then we readjust.
It's a process of learning and changing and adjusting. And like you said, because a lot of the proponents of LOA, as Louis, and he, maybe he believes more in the LOA teachers than he does in the scientists, but they've been wrong a lot. So
there's always missing the mark. I think to me, the great value is in, for myself, removing the idea of right and wrong from the whole thing. Cause I don't think there's any right or wrong where it comes to learning, information and developing learning, developing our understanding of stuff. There's, I got it or I didn't get it. I discovered this, or I thought I discovered something, but what I really discovered was something else. But I'm not sure there's really right or wrong where that's concerned.
Well, I'm talking about like predictions. Predictions. They've been wrong about their predictions.
Well, if you miss the mark, are you wrong?
Yeah,
you just simply needed to readjust your aim?
No, but if you say something is going to happen, the prophecies of something happening at a particular time, and it never.
I haven't heard any LOA teacher talk about prophecy.
Oh, actually. Yes, I have. Trust me. Even Abraham had made prophecies that didn't happen.
Okay, what were those? I'm curious because I missed them.
Yeah, they're on the web. Prophecies about certain things happening as far as the society is concerned, certain diseases, certain things happening with the economy. I don't know exactly what the prophecies
are. Kind of go against what they teach because they tell you everything changes based on what you believe. So.
Oh. So that they no longer prophesy. So that tells you something.
So they're learning.
Yes.
Well, with that thought in mind, I want to, first of all, wrap up the hour because we're actually past the hour. Second of all, I want to remind people who are not yet subscribers of the podcast to become one. This is where you get this really good discussion on a variety of topics, particularly here on Monday, where we have the science team on one side and we have the LOA team on the other, and near the twain shall meet, except that we do every Monday. And, you know, you get that as part of your 5 days a week, and every single day it's different. So become a subscriber if you're not yet subscribed. And the main reason to do it, I think, it's why we call it your daily dose of happy. It feels better to listen to this. This is better feeling stuff. Talk about the difference between what feels better, what feels not so good. This is the easiest way to apply that particular rule because this always feels better. And you don't even have to think about it. You just know every time you tune in, it's going to feel better. So that's the reason to subscribe to LOA Today. And it's also the reason, by the way, if you don't listen to all the episodes, well, I can understand that. We're busy, but, you know, it is 5 hours a week. You have something on the order of, 40, 50, 60 hours, something like that. You have a few hours during the week. You can get a few more hours in, you know, make it a goal of getting one more hour in a week. It's going to make that much of a difference in your life, getting that extra hour. And so that's my little promo, but become a subscriber. If you don't really know how to do it, we set it up on the homepage of our website, loatoday.net, how to do it. Really simple. And check us out on YouTube. Most days we live stream to YouTube as we're recording today. The live stream to YouTube didn't quite work out, so apologies for that, but we're uploading it to YouTube after this. And I think we'll have to leave it there. It's going to be interesting going forward. Each Monday, it's going to be like this little tension going on. LOA, science. LOA, science. Which way is it going to go?
And LOA is not necessarily not scientific. So.
Well, that is true. I agree with that. And to me, that's the exciting part.
I don't think those are the two contrasts here. I mean, I don't have any problem with the science community. It's just not something I'm particularly focused on.
So. Sure. Yeah. I love the fact that they're converging. I mean, talk about a convergence of data.
Yeah, that's
really happening.
Makes it interesting to me because everything.
I agree with you completely. Yeah. It's that convergence, which I'm hearing from you about that scientists that are starting to see what the LOA guys or not LOA guys, but
traditional.
Some old knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. There we go.
What's old is new and what's new is old.
That's right. Yep.
So thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you especially to our podcast listeners as well. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.